Hello, everybody, and welcome to the first episode of Casually Serious, a new podcast series between two University of Toronto student clubs, a Moment of Science, Please, and the Undergraduate Research Students Association. I'm your co-host, Daphne, and I'm a third-year undergraduate student double majoring in molecular biology and human biology.
I'm Clara, your other host, and I'm a second-year student in cell bio and chemistry.
And so, on this podcast, made by students for students, you can expect us seriously asking some awesome guests some interesting and fun questions about their careers, research, science, and beyond.
Today is super exciting because we have with us our first guest on the podcast, Dr. Kenneth Yip, a well-known professor at U of T in the Cell and System Biology Department and an established cancer researcher at Princess Margaret Cancer Center. He is also currently the scientific lead of anticancer.ca and has previously co-founded a biotech startup.
Dr. Yip, thank you so much for joining us today and giving us your time.
Thank you for having me. Really excited to be here.
And so to begin, I think that many of our listeners know you from these really big introductory biology classes, for example, Bio 130 and Bio 230. But you also taught many other ones like CSB 331 and CSB 202. In general, what has been your teaching experience here at U of T, and do you have any favorite classes?
So the experience has been fantastic. I think in terms of courses and class sizes, I really enjoy the extreme ends of the spectrum. So I really like large classes like Bio 230, and Bio 230 are enrollments over 1400 students. But at the same time, I also enjoy the independent research project courses where I get to work with students one-to-one. In Bio 230, we have a lot of students who are really excited to learn about new and advanced scientific concepts. We get to talk a lot about cancer, which is my area of interest. A con would be that I don't get to know all the amazing students that we have. Whereas in the independent research project courses, I really get to work with students one-to-one. I really get to see them develop and get better at scientific thinking.
I think like a common concern for a lot of incoming people for U of T is this fear of these huge classes and perhaps, not really being heard. So, do you have any like recommendations for first and second years who are going into these really big classes on how to best take advantage of all the resources available to them?
Yeah, I think in the large lecture halls, you probably won't get heard. I mean, we do a lot of the lectures in convocation hall, so there's definitely not enough time to go through all student questions when you have a class of more than 1,000 students. But I think there's a lot of different opportunities outside of class, after class, before class to really get involved. So whether it's going to office hours, staying for tutorial sessions, talking to the teaching assistants, all the labs that we run in those courses have maximum of 25 students or so. So there are lots of opportunities to interact with course staff and course professors on a one-to-one basis.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree with that. Like I'm taking CSB 331 currently, and it's but definitely a smaller classes compared to Bio 130 or Bio 230. And I think like a pro for me is definitely having more interactions with the prof and like definitely having the time to like a one-on-one conversation. And I feel like the con would be like the bigger courses are not recorded, are recorded, and the smaller ones aren't. So like it really like pushes me to go like take all my notes down and like having to like think more in during class rather than after class, where like Bio 230, you can have the chance to go back and rewatch your lectures and understand at home, while like CSB 331 was like more like, okay, I don't understand this, I need to go ask about this later. So
Office
I would
hours.
say like, yeah, of course. Office hours, oh my goodness, helped so much. So I think for me, definitely as a student, from a student perspective, I think the pros and cons are definitely there. And these like big courses, I'm always interested in like, because at the end of each course, we have like student evaluations. And sometimes me and my friends would be like, did you fill it in? Like, did you actually like give a feedback? And these feedbacks sometimes could be super useful, I feel, to further develop how like future courses could look like. So we were just wondering, like, the teaching team must get so many like different opinions from students. How do you guys use these opinions or feedbacks to formulate further like course changes?
Yeah, so absolutely. We really go through and we really appreciate the student course evaluation survey. So you hear from a huge number of students, and what kind of the background team does at the University of Toronto is they tabulate everything, they give us quantitative statistics, they summarize all the qualitative opinions, and they accumulate all the qualitative opinions. And so it's a really good representation of the student experience as a whole. And definitely the teaching team, I know, I guess it depends on the course, depends on the professor, but for me, 100%, I read every single one of them and I go through every single one of them and I try to get a sense of what the whole class thinks and to really try to improve from there.
And so these course evaluations are sort of the official source of opinions. But we also know that there are sites like RateMyProf and Reddit. We're wondering if the teaching team checks these sites at all, if they synthesize the comments there in any way?
Yeah, so I think that depends on the professor. I've heard from some professors that they do check those things. For me, people have shown me RateMyProf, have shown me Reddit, but I personally try not to look at those things because I don't want anecdotal student comments to influence the way I teach. And I also think from what I've seen, the little that I've seen is that the opinions do tend to be quite polar. Either you're the best of the best or you're the worst of the worst. Although I definitely have, again, had friends and colleagues and students show me funny things. Again, I really like the U of T student course evaluation surveys because it really is a huge number of students with all the quantitative statistics, qualitative opinions. And if we look at the student surveys, every year we get hundreds and hundreds of students completing them versus probably a lot less on some of those websites.
Yeah, definitely. Like Reddit is definitely like extreme website. you get many different opinions and sometimes people just go on there to like vent about their experience. So sometimes opinions can be biased. Mostly are biased actually. But I feel like platforms like Reddit is like kind of a way to kind of see, or like just opinions in general, like feedbacks is a way to like connect with students in a way to see how like student feedbacks and such. I know Professor Yip has opened an Instagram account to help better connect with the students. How has that experience been? Like, I was just wondering, like, how has opening an Instagram account and like posting memes, how has that experience been for you, that journey?
Yeah, so we originally started some of these social media accounts because we wanted to get the word out on all sorts of scientific research opportunities, job opportunities that were out there that we couldn't necessarily post on our standard U of T course websites because a lot of these opportunities were outside the scope of the University of Toronto, say with various pharmaceutical companies and those kinds of things. And University of Toronto doesn't want to really be seen as necessarily advertising for these companies. But at the same time, a lot of undergrads were looking for these types of opportunities. So that's kind of why we originally started it. But then we found that it was a great way to connect with students outside of course material, to talk about some fun things. And it kind of snowballed from there. And a lot of students gave us really good feedback about wanting more of that stuff. So that's kind of why we have that stuff out there.
So on the topic of all these student opinions, we also know that there are these certain stereotypes about U of T and we're known as U of Tiers. So what is your opinion on that? And what do you think are some areas U of T could improve, but also what are some areas do you think U of T has done really, really well, especially in terms of research opportunities?
Yeah, so I never heard about U of Tiers until you told me that this question was coming. So I looked it up on Instagram. I know very little bit about it, so I'm probably not a good person to ask about it. But just if I had to give my initial comments, I just say that I think the underlying experiences, the pressures, the feelings are not only common to students around U of T, but to many university-age students across Ontario, Canada, North America, and the world. And probably not just university, but probably common to college or film school or dance school, or wherever a lot of young people are studying and working hard. I think for research opportunities, there are definitely a lot around the Toronto area. But unfortunately, there wasn't really a comprehensive or easily accessible list. So I actually spent some of our money and hired a student along with other work to compile a list of the opportunities. And you can find it on my Instagram, my X/Twitter, where we make it publicly available. And again, some of these opportunities are outside University of Toronto, say with various companies. So we don't post it on our course websites. I don't know if you're able to make those accounts and lists available to students on a link somewhere.
Yes, I believe on our end, you can find it in our Instagram bio, in our link tree at UFT URSA.
Great, fantastic.
Yeah, since we're on the research topic about research at UFT, UFT does have a lot of like just in uni resources. And currently, I believe today, February 20th, is the day that ROP is like open for application for like the summer term and for winter fall term of from like 2024, 2025 year. And there are a lot of other like research opportunities here, like the research courses, as also work study and research awards. As someone who leads a cancer research team and does research at Princess Margaret, what do you think undergrads should do or mention to in their like application, resume, CV to improve their chances or stand out in the crowd?
Yeah, for a student CV, I think two things really come to mind. The first thing is that any professional work experience is a definite advantage. And then the second thing is it can actually help to include a bit about hobbies and interests. In terms of work experience, a lot of students think that you need to have research experience, but that's definitely not the case. Undergrads are not going to go into a lab, but they're not going to contribute immediately and revolutionize the science. Even if you have a lot of research experience, we'd still have to reteach you how our lab does things and how to use our specific scientific equipment. So having an undergrad with research experience really doesn't save that much time over a term, or over a summer, or over a year. What I think a lot of researchers actually look for is someone who is professional, can show up on time, that is committed, and probably most importantly, can get along with the folks that are already in the lab. So work experience really helps to demonstrate these types of things. And I think hobbies and interests are also really important. You never know when something resonates with a researcher or someone needs a certain set of skills. We've seen researchers want to hire students with art experience to help draw things, or tech savvy students to help with a lab website. One year in our lab, we were getting a lot of funding from these triathlons or marathons to help fight cancer, to raise money for cancer. And they wanted us to send someone to run a marathon or participate in triathlon. And I couldn't do it at the time, and our staff couldn't do it. But one of the students that applied to work in our lab, they did that as a hobby. So we said, oh, yeah, 100% come into our lab. You can represent the lab and we can teach you a bit of science. So you really never know when some of those hobbies really resonate with some of the staff involved.
Wow, that's really interesting that something you might not think could get you hired actually is sort of the defining trait in your application. So on the topic of research, because UFT has all these research opportunities available from cancer to fibrosis to Alzheimer's and anything in between to physics, you name it, how did you realize what you wanted to do for research?
Well, for me, it was a real gradual process. So I went through high school and undergrad at a time when a lot of exciting discoveries were being made or had just been made in biology. It really seemed like anything was possible. So this was around the period, maybe a bit after the period that Dolly the sheep was cloned, maybe around the period or a bit after the period that the Human Genome Project was completed. It really seemed like that in science, in biology, you can make discoveries with a big impact on the world. And so I studied life sciences and I moved towards research. And then in grad school, I wanted to work on a big problem in the life sciences. So I started to work in cancer research. So it was just really kind of going down what interested me, going down that path, and then moving towards things that became more and more interesting to me.
Yeah, I guess I feel like a lot of students nowadays, I feel like it's also about, oh, going to a course, seeing like what they like and going down that path and just naturally pursue that path. And for you, Professor, like, is there like a highlight or a moment in your career where you feel like, this is why I'm doing this, this is why I'm here?
Maybe a career highlight that kind of comes to mind is that the editors of a fairly famous textbook asked me to contribute to a chapter about cancer for a new edition. And I didn't know the other contributors, but when it was finally published, the two names right before mine were two really famous scientists. So Robert Weinberg and Harold Varmus. And just for your audience, Robert Weinberg, he's credited with discovering the first oncogene and the first tumor suppressor, key discoveries in cancer. He also co-authored The Hallmarks of Cancer, which was required reading when I was in school. And Harold Varmus, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 1989 for the discovery of the origin of retroviral oncogenes. And he was also the former director of the National Institutes of Health in the US. And he was also the director of their National Cancer Institute. And I have a picture of with him that I always show to my students. But for me, it was just a really satisfying, nice career highlight. Because I felt like it was a combination of luck, kind of being in the right place at the right time, talking to those editors, but at the same time, really summarizing, putting together all the contributions and efforts up until then that I had done in cancer. Hopefully, putting a source together that helps the next generation of cancer researchers and students.
Wow, that's super impressive. Yeah, I think that all of us also read the Hallmarks of Cancer paper. So it's still really big even now. And so we focus a lot on sort of the academia side, but we also know that as you promoted on your X slash Twitter, that in November of last year, you and your team actually recently obtained a patent titled the Composition and Methods for Regulating ECM Accumulation. Could you tell us a little bit about your journey there, what that means for you and your team, and sort of what patents in general mean for your research?
Yeah, sure. So the patent was and is a really exciting milestone. It's going to allow us to license our technology to biotech companies, pharmaceutical companies who might be interested in developing new therapies for radiation fibrosis. So fibrosis is a common side effect of cancer treatment. And having the patent also strengthens our ability to secure funding, attract talented students, postdocs, other staff. And, it's a little bit of a start. There's still much more work that needs to be done. Related patents have to be filed and obtained, but it's another step towards eventually getting new medicines into the clinic. So it's a difficult step that I'm very proud to have contributed to, but it's also still at the initial phases when we think about eventually getting a new medicine into the clinic.
Yes, like super interesting and exciting for someone to listen to hear as someone who has fairly no research experience. but we're working there. Since we're on the subject of research, I feel like as a life sci student, like we're both, me and Daphne are li in life sci. When you enter life sci, you kind of hear there's like two paths you go to. You either go down research or you go down, oh, I'm pre-med, med school. It's there. It's just those two. We were wondering, like, could you tell us a bit about, like, since you co-founded a biotech startup, could you describe your experience working in an industry or maybe like with industry professionals, see how like the biotech industry or just in the industry for life science in general, how is that the scenery for there look like?
Yeah, for me, it was something that developed along the way. So as an undergrad student, still a long, long ways to go, I think, before you have to think too much about kind of academia versus industry and those kinds of things. So for me, my industry kind of experience started after my PhD. So I went to do a postdoctoral fellowship in San Diego. My supervisor, John Reed, was an academic scientist and very accomplished academically. At the time, he was the doctor of the decade, the most published scientist in biomedicine for 10 years. But he also started a company with Robert Horvitz. And Robert Horvitz, another academic scientist, so Robert Horvitz won the Nobel Prize in 2002 for discoveries in cell death. So throughout my postdoctoral work, yes, we were doing academic science, but also there were companies being spun out of our work. And so that was a really great time, really great place that encouraged innovation, encouraged translating our discoveries into a path that could potentially benefit patients. And my supervisor and mentor went on from our academic institute at the very next level. He became the head of pharma and research and early development at Roche. And then went on to some other companies. So I think it's very important for students to understand that there are plenty of researchers, plenty of places where academia and industry work together. So in addition to academics starting companies, there are plenty of well-established companies that provide funding for academics to research a certain topic. On top of that, there are lots of companies that have their staff run research labs just like someone would in academia. And plenty of people move between being a research professor at an academic institute at a university and then also being in industry.
And on the topic of industry, as a person who has only done research in academia, the whole concept of industry seems very elusive and mysterious. So with your experience, what would you say are some of the key differences between academia and industry, from, you know, research freedom to work culture, salaries, et cetera?
So, I actually see more difference between academic departments than I do between academia and industry. In terms of very broad generalizations, I guess the yearly salaries are a bit better in industry, although there's less stability. Generally, there's a bit more research freedom in academia. You know, work culture, I think that's very company and academic department or institute dependent. Probably the best answer that I can give is that I'm always very surprised when I hear broad generalizations and sweeping statements about industry versus academia. I think it really depends on the specific company, the company department, the academic department. And I also think that plenty of places allow you to do a bit of both. And I think a lot of people who both work in academia and also work in industry don't realize that a lot of big companies were founded by academic professors or co-founded by academic professors. So if you think about some really, really big companies like Amgen, like Biogen, Genentech, Genzyme, Vertex, Regeneron, Immunex, these are all companies that were founded or co-founded by academics. So there really is space to move between the two, and there's a lot of overlap between the two as well.
And nowadays, like, there are so many, honestly, a lot of people starting, like, they're either their own websites or startups or getting into the biotech companies. Another initiative that you introduced was a website called anticancer.ca. How did this idea come about? How did the idea of creating anticancer initiate?
You know, I've been a cancer researcher for many years, with much of my work being devoted towards developing new cancer therapeutics. Now, while we're doing this, everyone kind of knows, and this is a basic statistic from the WHO, as well as from other organizations, we all know that cancer is a leading cause of death. Worldwide, 1 in 6 deaths are from cancer. Yet organizations like the WHO also tell us that 30 to 50% of cancers are considered preventable. So for a long time, I pretty much every day walk to work thinking about how difficult it is to develop new cancer medications, but at the same time thinking about how there's already so much that we know that could be done to help prevent cancer. So eventually, I helped to co-found anticancer.ca, and we really focus here on evidence-based nutrition for an anti-cancer lifestyle.
So yeah, it's really cool hearing how sort of the idea initiated. Could you tell us a little bit more about the contents of the website, how we can best use it to get the most out of it?
Yeah, so far we have built the website, but we're of course working to expand beyond the web to work with community members. On the website, we have articles, information about eating well to prevent cancer, recommendations for specific types of cancer. We have a nutrient database that reviews particular nutrients. We inform people about foods with important nutrients, various pros and cons of the nutrients, and the evidence from related clinical trials. In addition, we have tools that help with general and long-term advice. So we're often told to focus on fruits and vegetables, to eat lean meats, to have unsaturated fats and omega-3s. But long-term, this can be a little bit challenging. Like a lot of people, when I hear this advice, I might go eat lots of salads for a couple of days, and then halfway through the week, I'll be, you know, I'll say, oh, I'm out. I'm going to go get some burgers and fries. And then I'll never go back to the recommendations again. So anticancer.ca also has a meal plan and recipe generator that really helps to give ideas for healthy meals from all sorts of cuisines and cooking styles for long-term adherence, advice on how to adjust meals just slightly to really push you towards having a cancer preventative lifestyle. We also have AI-based chat tools that you can ask specific questions to if you don't want to read through all the articles. And I think this is particularly useful for summarizing a lot of key points. So as an example, one of my favorite resources is a report entitled Diet, Nutrition, Physical Activity, and Cancer, A Global Perspective. And this is a huge report produced by the World Cancer Research Fund International, the WCRF. So what they did is they got together an independent panel with over 100 contributors. So, you know, nutritionists, doctors, researchers, et cetera. And they analyzed worldwide data across many cancers to put together evidence-based cancer prevention recommendations. And I think this is the starting point for science-based cancer prevention. But their report totals over 12,000 pages. So I don't think most people are going to read it. Like I've been a cancer researcher for many years. I've kind of read it, but I can't tell you what was on page 11,000 versus what was on page 34. So it's really comprehensive. And the summary alone is over 100 pages. So again, I don't think most people are going to read it. And even if you've read it, it's really difficult to apply. So we have some AI tools where you can just ask your specific question. It can go through the report and give you an answer. So we have a lot of current and upcoming tools on our website that hopefully can promote the cancer preventative lifestyles.
Oh, yeah. The website seems like has a lot of like useful tools. I know I have a friend in an FS taking nutritional science course, and for one of their assignments, they had to like generate meal plans, record what they eat. And then he did use anti-cancer to like see what kind of meals he could have. And it was just like a lot of like his favorite food. And he's like, okay, this works. I'm going to go buy this.
Fantastic.
So yeah. So that was like really interesting to see how it gives you like the amount of portions, the calories. So it's definitely look forward to the future of see the development of anti-cancer. And on the development like topic, how do you envision like further a development of like the website or even like platforms of social media, how to promote it, how to get more, I guess, hit the target audience and hit more followers for the website?
Yeah. So, I mean, the website's our start, but we are planning and we're currently working with some of these people. We're planning to work with the public, health food companies, nutrition companies, nutritionists, food and grocery companies, coffee shops, basically everyone we can to really help bring forward knowledge, highlight products and services that facilitate a decreased cancer risk. Our web, our social media presence, that really is just the start. And in terms of social media, we just started to grow on Instagram. So if I can plug it, you can add us at anticancerca, and we're planning more growth. So lots to come and lots to be announced. And of course, I'd like to say that we do really want to promote cancer prevention awareness and knowledge. So anyone out there can help by simply just following us and helping us spread the messages that we have.
Yeah, I mean, on that note, we are super, super excited to keep up with anticancer.ca as well as potential other biotech startups that you might co-found. And thank you so much for giving us your time. Before we go, do you have any last words of encouragement or advice for our listeners?
Yeah, in terms of final words of encouragement and final words of advice, I just like to say that we have amazing students here at U of T. I think a lot of students feel a lot of pressure to determine, to chart a path out for themselves that decides their whole career and what they're going to be doing for the next 40 years. But I don't think students should feel that kind of pressure. I mean, as you change, as you grow older, your interests will change. They should change. I think if you decided on a career now and your interests never change over the next 40 to 50 years, that would be extremely unreasonable. And that'd probably make you a very, very boring person. You're going to grow, you're going to change. And I think you should give yourself room to do that and go with your interests now, but over time, those things may change and you should embrace that change.
Yeah, that's reassuring for people who, are scared of making mistakes and losing out on, their career and their future. So yeah, thank you so much for that.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Yip. And viewers, listeners, you can find him on Instagram at Prof Yip and keep updated with Anti-Cancer at Anti-Cancer CA. For more episodes like this, please keep an eye out our club social media at UFT URSA and AMOSP UFT. Thank you all for joining.
Thank
Thank
you.
you, Daphne. Thank you, Clara.
Thank you.